Hi, I'm Ryan Meeks, and after years of trying to make life work as a struggling artist, independent filmmaker, and musician, I thought to myself, hey self, wouldn't it be helpful to ask other artists how they're finding their path in this world? And so now, that's exactly what I'm doing on a bi-weekly basis. Welcome to The Path of Art. Welcome to The Path of Art. Today on our show, we have Peter Breinholt. So Peter Breinholt is a musician from Utah who's very popular in Utah, and he's got quite a portfolio here. And Peter, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to have you on.
Yeah, we're old friends, huh?
Yeah, we ended up connecting back in the day. And in fact, I think I ran into you a few years ago when I was with KSL News Radio, and we went down to interview Jim Caviezel at the OUR
thing.
And I think I ran into you, and I just said hi, and it's
2018. I can give you the exact thing.
I
remember that.
And he had a song of yours that was connected to the documentary.
They used it in the film, and that's why we were there.
You've done a lot of music, and I wanted to know what inspires you to write your music?
Well, there's the bigger inspired, like what inspired me to get into music, and then there's individual songs. And not to complicate the question, but I got into music, because it was the thing I just kept coming back to. I had lots of hobbies growing up, but I always came back to music. And then two, I came to a point in my life where I had to make a decision. And while my friends are going off to graduate schools and starting careers and stuff, I just struggled. I really struggled. I still struggle with it, actually. But at the time, it was like all the doors opened for music. I would just put forth a little effort and record, you know, do a show here, put out, you know, make a homemade tape and play it to friends and stuff. And it just seemed like that's where all the energy was with everything I was doing. All the doors were opening. So that led me into music. I felt like, you know, what else am I going to do? And this is kind of life is pointing me in this direction. And then in terms of how I write songs, it's all kinds of ways, but, I'm a fan first. I would say the number one inspiration for me is other music. I'm still like kind of obsessed about finding new songs that bring some kind of new inspiration to you. Or that energy. You know that feeling where you hear a song and you're like, oh my gosh, where is that? I got to download that now. And then you listen to it 20 times that day. Like I'm still on the hunt for those songs, you know?
Right.
And those have a tremendous effect. I often turn around and like, I want to do that. I want to come up with my own version of that. I just want to get back into the practice of creating music. It never gets old.
What songs would you say that you've played the most throughout your career on stage?
Well, there's the songs off the very first album are probably there's a couple on those ones. They're, you know, we don't have hits. We're not, you know, radio band, but we do have like kind of hits.
Like crowd favorites or something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So You Wear Flowers, mm-hmm. Which is on our first album, which is kind of it's really upbeat song. That one, although we have done plenty of shows without playing that song, that song is one that people really always want to hear. And people ask me all the time, do you ever get tired of playing that song? It's three chords. And, you know, you want to say, the performer in me wants to say, no, but yeah, the band jokes behind the scenes are like, well, we got to play Flowers. Mm-hmm. We don't, again, we don't always, but that's fun. But it actually, that song serves a function in the show too. Like even though
like kind of a turnaround in the energy of the show.
Exactly.
Right?
We put it right in the middle of the show. It's like it cleans the palate. Like once we've done that show, reset. It's like we've got oftentimes the crowd is on their feet, and then we can do anything after that song. It's a real attention getter. It brings a lot of energy to the show. So even if the band is sometimes, you know, kind of, we don't roll our eyes at the song, but sometimes we're like, okay, here's the part of the show where we got to do it. And we are on autopilot, which I hate to admit. We understand the function of that song in the show. It resets the whole show. So that's one. Jerusalem and What About are also off that first album. And all of them have had periods where we let them rest. We just left them out of the show. We didn't do Jerusalem for a few years. We didn't do What About for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. So
What About's been a fan favorite. You've redone it a few times, one on a EFY album, and on your best of, maybe it's the same. Maybe that's the same as the EFY version. Is that?
Yes, that is. And then we did a live. We did a live version of it on the live album,
right.
and we modeled that one after the
right.
2000 version.
And so you had set that one aside for a while.
Yeah.
And so what about it brought it back onto the stage with you guys? Just the feeling, you just felt like it was time to bring it back?
I think on that one, so as we were talking about before, like sometimes you put a song aside just because it reaches a point where it feels like you know, when you're on stage playing it, that some of the feeling's gone or you're in autopilot a little bit and you don't want that. You want to fill your show with songs that are alive. Mm-hmm. For the band. And that one had kind of gone that way. So we set it aside. And often when we do that with the song, they creep back on their own when they're ready. It's like they have, you know, a mind of their own. And it'll come sometimes in the form of a rearrangement or you're jamming. I don't know if you watch the Beatles Get Back, but they would start every session by playing old songs from their club days, from the Cavern days. And then they would move into the new songs, and just a warm up. But we'll do that too as we rehearse. Suddenly, you'll do like we just reinvented this song called "And She's True" from our second album.
That's, oh yeah,
and we went years without playing that song because it was what I would call a mid tempo malaise.
Mm-hmm. Like, it is pretty mid tempo. Yeah,
it's mid tempo. Mm-hmm. It's not. And live shows are often about the extreme. So you want the upbeat and you want the super mellow, but the mid tempo malaise songs, you know. You can't do too many of those. So that's where "And She's True" fit. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember what I may have heard a song on the radio that was like, oh, like "And She's True" could follow this a little bit. Like it was the song was originally patterned after a band called The Sundays. And anyway, I kind of rearranged it, and it is now the number one song in our show after 15 years of never playing it. So they creep back and they're better than ever. And then you kick yourself because you're like, why didn't we record it that way?
Right, yeah.
So What About, I think the thing with it, What About, I had written a string arrangement and I was really happy with that. And that was one piece of it. But even with that, we let it rest for a while. And I think it was doing, we did a show at the Sandy Amphitheater and it was not in the set list. And I think I got a double encore. And so I wasn't planning on doing it. I did it. And I think, I don't know, it was kind of like, there it is. It's new again. Feels great. So we brought it back in, I think, 2021 maybe. It's back.
Oh, cool. And so we have a live recording of the new What About.
Yeah.
Was that the...
It's the Ed Kenley Amphitheater.
Ed Kenley.
It's in Layton, Utah. And it's a 4th of July show. And we had a string section playing with us, and we got some of the best players. I mean, this is a real great.
It sounds really
section.
Full. It
yeah.
sounds, and he gave me a sneak peek before the show, and it sounds really full. Let's listen
to this new live version of What About.
Stand there and So I said, hallelujah, my love, but nothing now.
That's those strings really add a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, normally it was just a cello, which gave it a really good feel, but those extra strings really add quite a bit. I can see why you brought it back into.
Yeah. And that's when you again, you know, you had the advantage of two decades, you know, and you do a better version and it's, and you're like, oh, I should have recorded it originally this way. And that's why people do live albums. And that's why they do sometimes even re-recordings. Like there are certain greatest hit albums, you know, where they actually re-record this. You know, James Taylor's most famous versions are not the original versions. They were re-recordings for the greatest hits album.
And so have you always produced your own music? Or does someone else produce your music?
Combination. I produced the first 15 years of albums. So,
like recording as well, like you recorded yourself?
No, we would always, go into back. So back then it's different now because mm-hmm. people have software and computers and rooms. Mm-hmm. You can do it yourself, which is how I did my most recent album. Completely recorded at home, and I produced all, and I just had Scott Wiley down in Provo mix it. And first three albums, we would go into professional recording studios, but I was the one paying, first of all, and then I was the one bringing the songs and saying, okay, we want a four-piece band on this one, you know, do this, play that. I'd arranged them, and, you know, it helped that we were performing live a lot. Some of these songs were road tested and ready to go. But I was the one who had I was like the director. I had the ultimate say. And then in 2006, it had been 7 years since I'd done an album, and I was really sort of struggling over that. And I felt like I had a writer's block, and I approached Scott Wiley down at June Audio. He's the best.
He's a local mixer producer.
He's a producer, yeah. So he has a. It's called June Audio. It's in Provo. It's since been expanded into a world class studio down there. And the Killers, and Imagine Dragons, and Neon Trees. A lot of these bands have recorded there and worked with Scott. And so he's good. And mm-hmm. so we went to lunch. And yeah, at this point, I hadn't done an album in 7 years, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to let go of the reins. Would you produce this? And he's like, well, here's what I would do. I'd get rid. He actually said, you've got your tried and true band. I would actually get rid of them for this album because I know I listen to your albums. I know where they're going to go, and that's true of any musician, right? So we brought in all new players, and it was a whole new process, and I really learned on that album to let go and just trust somebody else's instinct. And we came up with an album called All the Color Green, which is my wife's favorite album, and I'm very proud of. And it worked. Mm-hmm. And then the next album after that, we were into the realm of, you know, recording in my home studio. And I just tracked. It was a whole different experience, and I'm proud of that one too. So
we're going to move on to a break, and when we get back, we're going to go into how Peter got started. Just we're going to go over his path and see just how he got to where he is and what he learned along the way. So we'll be right back. Back to the Path of Art. We're here with Peter Breinholt, a Utah musician who's been doing this thing for quite a long time. And since before your first album in the 90s, I mean, you've been performing. So he's got like 30 years plus just doing music successfully in Utah, which is something to look up to. I mean, what got you started in all of this? I mean, what got you interested in writing music?
It goes back to my childhood. Like anybody who loves music, I had experiences pretty young age where I just got sucked in to certain songs. And
did you also stay up until like 2 a.m. learning guitar solos?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And trying, like, my earliest memories are, and I don't want to bore the audience with the whole story, but mm-hmm. I just do remember we had a piano, and we weren't a musical family. My dad was kind of musical, but we had a piano there, and I'd have these moments where I'd experience something with the song. You know, I've said in other interviews that, like, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, God Only Knows, there's certain songs where I would go and I would try to figure them out by ear. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like just fascinating trying to capture whatever it was that made me feel moved.
The magic
can I get
there.
Yeah. Can I recreate that? Mm-hmm. And that's how it started for me. And it just never left. And then so by the time – so I remember I had a – in junior high, I had kind of a re-explosion of music in my life. And it was a time in my life where I had I just had the time to do it, and I really started writing songs, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, mm-hmm. on the piano. I didn't know how to do lyrics, just melodies. High school comes along, and by that point, you have friends who play, so you form bands. I was lucky because I was at a school where they'd actually give us opportunities to play dances and assemblies and what they called stomps and mostly covers, but in the process of learning covers, like, I was the guy with the ear. And so the bass player couldn't figure out the bass line. I'd learn the bass line, teach it to him. Same with the piano. So I did that with hundreds of songs. And that actually taught me, that was my schooling. It taught me the anatomy of a song, mm-hmm. like the arrangement of a song. Okay, well, the bass usually, matches the kick drum. And you usually, it's like taking a class.
Right.
And so by the time I'm, 17, 18 years old, I start to apply all those rules or all those things I've learned to my own songs. And by that point, we had a lot of performing experience. But what was really sort of calling to me, so in college, I've become suddenly way more interested in just doing the Neil Young thing, just the solo Neil Young thing. Can I go and play at a club or at a coffee shop alone and carry my own? That it sounds funny, but that seems like the Mount Everest to me at the time. I was like, I can do it with a band playing cover songs. Can I write original songs, sit in the corner of this coffee shop and be of interest to anybody?
And that's the key though, right? Being of interest to anybody, because you can play at a coffee shop and have no one pay attention to you, but can you play and people go, hey, that sounds really good.
Yeah. And here's what was interesting about that. Mm-hmm. I did it. I did it. Mm-hmm. And people said nice things, and I got rehired. It was nice, but that's not what did it for. That's not actually what helped me get some traction. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I'm writing my songs, and I'm in college by this point. But I have an old, you remember those old Tascam 4-track recorders?
The ones with tapes?
Yeah.
My dad had one. So listening to your story, there's some real parallels to my junior high experience too. I got into writing back then too, and my dad had one of those 4-track recorders, and so I would record some of my songs. You don't want to hear them; they're bad. But yeah, so I know exactly what you're talking about. That's so funny.
So I had one. It was like nowadays people would use GarageBand or Logic or Pro Tools, but back then I had a 4-track, and I was like, I remember one Christmas winter break, I spent the whole break. I took the Beatles song Dear Prudence. I said, I'm going to recreate this song note for note. And I did it. And there's six guitars on that song. That's what I learned.
Oh, wow.
And so eventually I start building my own songs with this Tascam. And I'm in college by this point. And, I let somebody hear it. And this is in the day when every car had a tape player, and that was the bomb going off for me, because it was like their reaction. Like, yes, I'd been playing Geppetto's Pizza in the corner playing cover songs, but when I saw, when I sheepishly shared 6 songs that I'd recorded at home with a friend, and they put it in their Wagoneer there and listened to it for a week, and then came back and said, oh my gosh, you've got to record these songs. And I've dubbed 2 or 3 versions, copies of this tape, and given it to my friends. That's when I felt really encouraged.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of courage itself though, just to share your music with people that aren't family, and friends. Yeah. And to see what their reaction is.
Oh, yeah. like I played it cool, like, these old songs, old things I wrote. But inside I'm dying because it's like, this is it. This is what I dreamed about. Like they're either going to respond to these or they're not. And they did. And they did actually beyond what, I mean, they did in a big way.
So that kind of started your progression into doing your thing, you know, writing more music, recording it and getting it out there.
Yeah.
So was there a point that you thought it maybe was a bad idea? Because I get that all the time. And I know other artists kind of get in these these spots in our mind where we're just like, it's not quite imposter syndrome, but you just see how things are going and you know that you felt good about it before, but for some reason right now you really just don't.
I have them all the time. I still have them. Still, it's the bane of my existence. So yeah, this is actually, so early on, like there was a lot of stuff going on inside of me at this time because my heart and my experience were saying, you're meant to do music. And I was seeing the evidence of that as people were responding to my early demos. My head was saying, you know, not, you know, all your friends are preparing to take the MCAT and the LSAT and they're thinking about graduate. And I actually came from a family like that. All my siblings are academics and have graduate degrees. And my dad was a college professor. And so I had this battle going on, like, this is not legitimate. Even if everybody flips out over your music, this is just a hobby. Like, you can't do music. So, and there was a little bit, I think there's a little bit of, I don't know, shame is a strong word. There was a battle.
Were you ever told not to do it?
No. That's the funny thing. I think all inside of me. My dad, and I've told this story so many times. My dad is, you know, he's a Ivy League business professor. And then we relocated to Utah. But you know, in my mind, I was projecting onto him. He's like, this is not his idea of a conventional, solid, safe profession for one of his kids. When my dad heard what I was doing, he flipped out. He was so, like, supportive.
Oh, in a good way.
In a good way. And it was like, yes, I had full support of both parents. And I think some of it was, I'm going back, you know, 25 years now, 30 years. Some of it was cultural. I think, I don't know how it is in LA. I don't know how it is in other places, but I think it's Salt Lake City and the culture I was in. I was getting a lot of messages. It's like, look, you provide for your family. Don't be chasing all these dreams. You think about your kids.
Get married, have kids.
Yeah.
Or were you married at the time?
No, I wasn't.
No,
I wasn't. I didn't get married. I was doing music full time 6 years by the time I got married. So I had that advantage.
And so how did, like, now when that happens though, cause you did mention that every now and then, I mean, you have that doubt that just creeps in. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it looks different now. Cause now it's like, you know, back then it's like, I got to provide for my kids. And now it's like retirement. So I have actually, this gets into a bigger conversation for me, but I think over the years, you know, having years and years and years of having an internal battle where you have your successes and you're like, see, it's working. And then you have your down moments where you're like, what have I done? What have I been doing? You know, and then I have my moments when I'm like, I've done some good stuff, you know, and then I have other moments where I'm like, what have I not done? Like, you know, I got friends in this position. And so I think everyone does it. But for me, it's actually been, it's given way to maybe a, I don't want to get too philosophical, but I think there's been a sort of inner journey around it that has, like, I've learned a lot about fear. I've learned a lot about jumping off cliffs when your brain is saying don't do it. Mm-hmm. And I've just learned a lot about how things manifest and how a lot of the voices that I've been fighting in my head, that a lot of people fight in my head, are voices, are illusions. Does that make sense? I don't want to get too cosmic on you, but that's been a big part of what I've learned. And I've actually come to a place now where I look back and say, okay, music's part of what I'm supposed to do, but the other part is this other part of the journey, which has involved fear, has involved uncertainty, and has involved, it's been a beautiful thing for me as I look back on my life, and it all makes sense to me. And so, does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, you've broken through some barriers mentally to be able to pursue and continually pursue what you're doing. And I think we all have to do that. Yeah. I mean, I think everyone still is breaking through those barriers, and some never do.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that I'm just starting to break through some barriers that have held me back for a very long time. And I think the sooner someone can do that, the better.
Yeah, and it has to do with courage, and has to do with faith, has to do with, like, I had somebody once say to me, and this is a very intuitive person who's songwriting, like as a songwriter who has become almost a mystic in terms of how to, like, the songwriter whisperer. And she's not from Utah, but she said, I feel impressed to tell you, Peter Brienholt, I don't tell this to everybody, but the safe path is the risky path for you, and the risky path is the safe path for you. And what I didn't get it at first, but the more I thought about it, it's like, okay, well, the risky path is music, or
so she's talking down the illusion.
Yeah, she's saying for Peter Brienholt, it would be far riskier if he, out of fear, walked away from this risky journey he's been on and went and got a conventional job just to feel safe. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more risk in that for you, not for everybody, but for you, and vice versa. Like you stick with what you have felt so far guided and led to do, and you're going to be fine. I don't know if that makes sense, but it made sense to me.
it makes a lot of sense.
So I went right out of college. I recorded the first album 2 weeks after I graduated from college, and I'm living at home at my parents' house. So there's no, like, I have no overhead in my life. So that part was easy. And then the album did well enough that I ended up buying a home and living, and I had roommates, and I was basically making a living as a musician right out of the bat, or right out of the gate. And then it grew and grew, and then I got married and started having kids. And then around 2002, I was having a freak out moment, and I was like, okay, I got young kids now. Now what do I do? And I did start to explore job options. Mm-hmm. And I did, you know, I did things here and there, but I actually never committed to a full-time. I've never had a full-time job, if you know, except for my music. But I went down the path, you know, and my dad had several businesses. And so I do work for them. And then I did some video work, and I did some teaching. But I never got off the risky path.
What do you think is one of the most important lessons that you've learned from doing music?
So in 1993, 1994, 1995, 1996, stuff happened so fast that I had to learn a lot of stuff. You know, I had to learn about the LLC and paying sales tax and all that stuff and registering your business. But it was kind of on the fly, and there was always a point to it, right? I wasn't just learning it in school. It was like trying to play catch up with the reality of what was happening with my business.
And which kind of makes it hard to get over the learning curve, because you're just playing catch up.
You're just putting out fires.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I learned enough, and I had help back then. But, you know, but I was never aware, like, you know, you read about the Beatles, you read about Justin Bieber. You lead, you know, there's so many resources because they're on such a scale and there's so much happening so fast and there's such a budget that there's just people do, you know, there's an army of accountants.
Yeah.
And, well, and even the songwriting though, at that level, mm-hmm. like there's a list, like, so I'm not like I would probably do this if it presented itself and there was a need for it. I've always seen myself as a songwriter. And so when American Idol started happening and people would say, this is years ago, people would mm-hmm. say like, well, what do you think about that? Because people were becoming stars overnight.
Yeah, overnight.
On that. People, what do you think of that? And I'm like, you know, I'm a songwriter. I'm into
right. They were
Pete
great.
Townsend.
They were great performers, but it wasn't songwriting.
Yeah, that's not right. what I was really drawn to. Like, if mm-hmm. I'd love to sit and watch these guys write songs. That's what it's always right. been about that for me. Mm-hmm. And so when you get like, if you look at like, you know, Taylor Swift, who's a amazing mm-hmm. songwriter, but she also is in a position where she can loop in, can bring each time, you know, there's a new project coming. She has a never ending, list of resources in terms right. of co-writers.
Right. Which I think is probably really helpful because in writing a song, you always get to that point where you're like, I don't know if this sounds good anymore. You know, because
yeah,
I've heard
yeah.
it so many times. I've been trying to redo the lyrics so many times. I've recorded it this many times. Does this even sound good anymore?
Yeah.
And I think that's the advantage of having all those other people to be like, no, it doesn't, or, you know, to tell you what needs to be changed.
And collaborating presents its own challenges. Like it's not been easy for me. And I've always sort of been jealous. The Lennon-McCartney collaboration mm-hmm. or the, you know, there's so many of them, Elton John, bring Topham, and to have that person to say, it's too long, shorten it up, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I'm teaching a songwriting class at Snow College.
Oh, nice.
I did last semester. And I had the students, in the course of the class, I had them write 5 songs. Or was it 4? Anyway, the last one was a collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I remember like saying to them, like, I actually don't have a ton of experience. I don't like collaborating, but it's a very important skill to have. So we taught collaborate. And I had them pair up. And they had to collaborate and then present the songs. I think by and large, they were actually the best songs of the whole semester.
So you've been working on some new material?
Over the last few years, it's been interesting because with COVID, we stopped performing. I started posting like virtual performances, which a lot of people did, you know, or mm-hmm. and it was so, those are really fun to do. But somewhere in there, we sold our house and moved from one side of Salt Lake to the other side of Salt Lake. And we lost my rehearsal space. Like I had a studio. And so one of the guys in the band said, well, I think we got to just keep playing and let's just use my living room. And so he kind of took ownership of the rehearsal schedule for us, which I had typically done. And he's been really good at saying every week. And half the time I show up and wait, I don't know what we're going to do. But every week we've been doing it. And inevitably when you do that, you start coming up with new material. So in our case, what I've been doing is presenting a bunch of songs that I wrote and in some cases even recorded but never released. So they're B-sides. But I started running them by the band. So I have all these B-sides. And so I've been like songs that I just haven't released. So I started bringing them to these rehearsals and the band is tightening them up. And so suddenly we have a whole album's worth right now. We haven't recorded. I've been traveling a lot this summer, but we've been thinking in August or in the fall, we will maybe go into a studio and record them live. But on this most recent trip I took last week, I went to Lake Tahoe, and this always happens to me. I put my headphones on and I have a 7-hour, 8-9 hour drive. And, you know, I started listening to 80s music, like quirky, mechanical, obscure pop songs with great energy. And suddenly I want to do that. I want to take all these B-sides and do them that way. There's a certain production style that I'm kind of fascinated with. I always have been, but I was like, ooh, I could take these B-sides, which would not be a band process. It would be me alone mm-hmm. in the studio. And I would hate to do that with the band because they've been working these songs. But we'll see. I'll experiment with both. So either way, hopefully we'll get song. I mean, originally we were thinking we'll just call it Sessions, B-Sides, the B-Side. Mm-hmm. And there's some good stuff.
So this one's called The House by the Side of the Road. This is
a live record. This is a live recording from last December at the Rose Wagner Theater. Okay. And
there are souls with lives withdrawn in a place they call their own. And there's a star up in the heavens in a lonely firmament. And there are some who blaze a path where the highways never pass, but not me. Keep as close as I can be to the people I can see. So turn me around, don't hide those eyes. Explore across the countryside. Let me build my house beside the road. Where you can hear a drum and fiddle playing all alone out there. And there are noises in the night. Let the travelers travel light, but not me. Keep me close as I can be to the people I believe. So turn me around, don't hide those eyes. Across the countryside, let me build a house beside the road. Let the weary speak about their visions and their dreams and all the places they have seen, and they are welcome here. So get it dark to the end. I wanna be a friend to man. Stand, and I'll know what the travelers never know in this place beside the road. So turn around, don't hide those eyes. Explode across the countryside. Let me build a house beside the road. Where men are strong and men are weak. Where men are good and bad as me. Let me build this house beside the road.
You heard a new song from Peter Breinholt. Was that the first time it's been played? When you did this live recording?
I did a version of it once for a fundraiser.
Nice.
But it was incomplete. This was the first. Mm-hmm. And this still is incomplete.
Right.
But it feels like this was the first. It's the debut.
It's sounding good. I liked it.
Cool.
So I thought it was great. So just one more question. This has been a great interview. I've loved having you on here, just kind of talking about music and just kind of the similarities of, I think a lot of musicians kind of go through a lot of these things. And so if you ran into someone that was just starting out, like, I want to be a musician, you know, this is my passion, what advice would you give them?
It's so funny. I get asked this so often, and I still don't feel like I've got the answer for them, except, you know, I like, in my case, there was an underlying sense of purpose, even when I was kind of groping in the dark and not knowing if it was going to work out. There's just a, I think if you have that, and for me, it grew its way back. I mean, it goes way back to a young age. And I just think it's the kind of, if you can find, here's an example. So my second son is away at school. He's at a place called Kenyon College in Ohio. And it's away from home. He didn't know a single person there. He just had this dream to go there. It's this beautiful, it's like going to Hogwarts. It's this beautiful school. And he, at a kind of a young age, had that dream. And so we drop him off last year. And as a parent, you're like, you know, what are we doing? And you're worried. And he literally doesn't know anybody there. And we start getting feedback from him like a week later. And when he comes back for Thanksgiving and stuff, well, how was it? And he's just like, I love it. I'm supposed to be there. There are hard things. There are great things. But all through it all, I know why I'm there. And like I when I heard that, it was like music to my ears. I thought he can get through anything if he knows why he's there. And he's got friends who are transferring out or not coming back this year. It's not, he can't understand that. And so for me, it's like that with music a little bit. Like I just, and it's true of any career, really. I just have this underlying sense of purpose in it. Like, I don't really have any other choices. This is what I think I'm designed to do. And that has gotten me through a lot. You know, I remember a friend of mine who's a full-time musician, has been very successful, and people ask him the same question. And the way he puts it is like, you know, find out if this is what God wants you to do. And if you have that, then it's all you need. But anyway, I don't know if that's good advice for people.
I think that's very good understanding and perspective. Because a lot of times I'm not sure that, you know, I don't know if I'm supposed to be doing this, yeah. Right? And so I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, in terms of like how to navigate the music world in 2022, I'm not your guy because I haven't figured it out either.
Yeah, a lot has changed. There's been a lot that's changed.
For this songwriting class, you know, I had, I asked a pianist, Paul Cardall, to do a guest lecture, and he's in Nashville. He just did a Zoom, and I asked him because he does really well what I don't do really well, which is the business stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was like these kids, these students, like, it was like, oh, okay, like, this is what we want too. And I remember early on when I met him, and he would actually come and follow us to shows. We did a show in Rexburg, and he said, I didn't even know him. He just called me. He's like, would you mind if I tagged along and just shadowed you guys? I just want to observe. I'm like, sure. And so, and I remember hearing his early work, and I was like, But what he had was this vision and this kind of strategy, and he's killing it now. He's just absolutely killing it. And actually his music has caught up to him. Well, he's the opposite of me. It's like, to me, it's all about the music and the business will catch up. For him, it was business and the music will catch up. And that's exactly what's happened. So I've learned not to underestimate the value of that side of it. I'm just not your guy. I'm a right brain. I'm a creative mess.
I know exactly how you feel. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, listening to your new music and your old music.
It's just redone.
It's just been a great experience, and it's a great opportunity just to talk to you. And so thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it.
Do it again. Anytime.
Yes, let's do it.
And those of you listening out there, this has been The Path of Art with Peter Breinholt. We'll catch you next time. Thank you for listening to The Path of Art. If you or someone you know is creative and would like to tell your story, reach out to me at rmeeks@ksl.com. I might feature you on the show. If you liked our conversation, please make sure you follow the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. It really does help people to discover the show. Also, make sure you follow The Path of Art podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.